It's tonight on motivation. And think that we're going to listen and share the Dharma, especially the overview of the path to enlightenment, so that we can practice it and actualize it in our own mind stream in order to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. We have a sheet that says overview to the path to enlightenment. This is actually from the new book called Guided Meditations on the Path to Enlightenment. It's going to be a chart in the book. But I made it several years ago when I was teaching at DFF. And if you can learn this chart, if you can just even memorize the outlines on this chart, it will help you so much in your Dharma understanding, because then you'll have an idea of what are the major topics on the path to enlightenment and how they relate to each other and what order you practice them in and how they fit together. And if you understand that, it eliminates so much confusion. Okay? Because then whenever you hear a teaching, you know, because there's so many different teachings and so many different practices, if you understand this, then whenever you hear any teaching, you'll know where it belongs, okay? And so then you won't get confused when you hear something that seems very difficult to understand by thinking, oh, this must be at the beginning of the path, and how come I don't get it? Because you'll know, oh, wait a minute, this is something at the end of the path, and you understand it better if you understand all these other things first. Okay? So it helps, you know, if you understand this, it will really help you whenever you hear any teachings. And it will also show you, you know, how to practice the various teachings of the Buddha in a systematic way so that you don't get confused about what to practice when. Okay, and you'll really understand how all the different things fit together. So it's very, very helpful. Okay, so if you look at the chart, yeah, across, if we go down, yeah, we have the three levels of practitioner. So the path in common with the initial level practitioner, with the middle level practitioner, and then the path of the advanced level practitioner. So we cover this a little bit in the teachings of Essence and Refined Gold and in any Lamrim text. You know, you'll see this. This outline of these three levels of practitioner. And this was a systematization that was developed by Lama Tisha, who lived in the 11th century, who was instrumental in the second wave of propagating the Dharma in Tibet. Then across the top of the chart, okay, we have the aspiration to develop, what to meditate on to develop it, and what to practice once you have developed that aspiration. Okay? So we start out with the path in common with the initial level practitioner. And remember, it's in common with that practitioner because we're not stopping there and just doing that practice. We're doing it for the purpose of ultimately getting to be an advanced level practitioner. Okay, so we have some kind of respect and emulation and admiration and aspiration for bodhicitta in our mind, but we're practicing the path in common with the initial level practitioner. Okay, so it's kind of like if you want to go from the Abbey to, you want to go to Delhi, you want to go to Dharamsala, might as well do it. Okay, you want to go to Dharamsala. So to get to Dharamsala, okay, you have to pass through Seattle. Yeah, then you have to go to Tokyo. Then you maybe have to go to Singapore. And then you go, then you finally get to Delhi. And then you take another thing to Dharamsala. So although Seattle isn't your final destination, you take the flight in common with the people who are going to Seattle. Okay? And then you take the flight in common with the people who are going to Tokyo. Even though they're just going to Tokyo and you're going beyond that, you still take the same flight in common with them. Okay, but even though you're doing these things in common with them, your mind knows, I'm not getting off here, I'm going all the way to Dharamsala. Okay, so you're holding that view of Buddhahood and Bodhicitta in your mind, even though you're doing kind of the initial steps to get yourself there. Okay, because when you're here, you can't take the train from Delhi to Pathankot and the taxi to Dharamsala as your very first step. Can you? Because you're here, you're not in Delhi. So the same way, you know, when we practice the path, we have to start with where we're at. Yeah. We might think, oh, it's going to be so exciting when I'm in Delhi and I can get on the train and then, you know, the taxi up to Dharamsala. It's going to be so exciting. And you might have all sorts of excitement about that, but you still have to get from here to Seattle. Okay? So you might as well enjoy the trip from here to Seattle. Okay? And not get all dismayed because you're not on the, you know, going from Delhi to Dharamsala yet. Okay? And just enjoy your whole trip as you're going. Okay? So, yeah, the first thing we're doing is practicing the path in common with the initial level practitioner. So what kind of aspiration does that person have? Okay, so this is like the person who says, I aspire to go to Seattle. I'm at the Abbey and I aspire to get to Seattle. Okay, so the initial level practitioner, their aspiration is to die peacefully and to have a good rebirth. Okay? And so that person actually wants a good rebirth because they don't want to suffer in their next life. But because we're aiming to attain full Buddhahood, that's not completely our motivation when we want a good rebirth. Yeah, sure we don't want to suffer next life, but a deeper motivation for wanting a good rebirth is we want to be able to continue practicing the Dharma next life. And we know that if we don't have a good rebirth, if we have a lousy rebirth, forget about attaining enlightenment, forget about benefiting anybody else, we're going to wind up in a horrible rebirth ourselves. Okay? So we want to be able to, you know, attain enlightenment. We need that good rebirth in order to do that. So you see, we're still practicing the path in common with the initial level practitioner, but our motivation's a little bit different. Because somebody who's initial, they just don't want to have suffering. Whereas we want to have the opportunity to have a rebirth to continue to practice. Even though we're both aspiring for a good rebirth. Okay? So it's like the difference between the person who's saying, I want to get to Seattle, and the person who's saying, I want to get to Seattle so that I can go to Tokyo and Delhi and Dharamsala. Okay? So, how do you, before you can do anything to act out that aspiration, you have to generate that aspiration. You know, you have to want to go. So what do you think about to train your mind or to inspire your mind so that you want to do that? Okay? You know? So it's like we got to get ourselves on the plane and we got to get to Seattle. So what do we think about so that we think of the benefits of getting to Seattle? Okay? So the first things we meditate on the path, you know, we consider precious human life. Yeah, that we have this very unique opportunity that has incredible potential and has a lot of great meaning, but that it's rare to attain this opportunity, and it's also difficult to attain it. Okay, so that's the first thing we meditate on. Then the next thing we meditate on is we think that this precious human life isn't permanent. It doesn't last forever. Okay? we're going to die. Things are changing moment by moment. We're not always going to be who we are right now. We're not always going to have this chance to practice. Okay? So that kind of wakes us up a little bit more, huh? You know, we can't take our life for granted. Then the next thing we meditate on is what's going to happen to us at the time of death. Well, there's the definite possibility, if, you know, we haven't practiced the Dharma, that we'll have an unfortunate rebirth. And so then we do the contemplations on the three unfortunate rebirths, you know, being born as an animal, as a hungry ghost, and in a hellish realm. So that really activates us. It's like, I have this precious opportunity. It's not going to last forever. And I may not get it again because I may wind up in a state of a lot of suffering. Okay? So that makes you, when you meditate on those three things, that makes the aspiration to have a good future rebirth really strong. Okay? You getting what I'm saying? It's like, I want to go to the lower realms. I really want a good rebirth. And so that's my aspiration, to have a good rebirth. So what you train your mind in first is the precious human life and permanence and death and the possibility of a lower rebirth. That generates in you the aspiration to have a good rebirth. And then what do you do to be able to create the causes for the good rebirth? So once you have that aspiration, what do you do to actualize that aspiration? Well, there's two things, refuge and following karma and its effects. And so that's in that other tab, the other column about what you practice once you've developed that aspiration. So refuge helps you, because when you don't want to have a bad rebirth and you want to have a good one, then you realize, I need some help. You know, I need somebody to teach me, what do I practice and what do I abandon, so that I can abandon the causes of a bad rebirth and create the causes of a good rebirth. So who is most fit and capable of instructing me on this matter? It's the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the three jewels. Okay? And so then we entrust our spiritual guidance to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, because we know that we really desperately need some guidance. Yeah. Then, once we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and saying, I trust you to guide me on the path, because you've accomplished the path yourself and you've generated all of those qualities, so therefore, you know, teach me what you did to get where you're at, then the first thing the Buddha says is learn about actions and their results. Yeah? Learn about causality in terms of our psychological, physical mechanism. You know, what actions lead to what kind of results? Because if we know that, then if we don't want a bad rebirth, we'll know what kind of actions to abandon. And if we want a good rebirth, we'll know what kind of actions to practice, and we'll not just know them, but we'll actively engage in that process. Okay? So that takes some effort on our part, doesn't it? We're not just turning to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and taking refuge and saying, Buddha, I don't want a horrible rebirth, save me from the lower realms! And that's it. You know? Okay, rather, the Buddha says, you know, don't do these 10 negative actions and do the opposite. Okay? So the Buddha's given us the medicine, but then we have to take the medicine. Yeah. If you go to the doctor and you get a prescription and you don't fill it, or even you fill it but you don't take the medicine, you're not going to get well. So, you know, we can learn about karma, but then we have to really practice it, you know, and start that process of engaging in the 10 virtues and abandoning the 10 non-virtues. And so we have to do that within the context of our daily life. Because the only time we ever have to practice is right now. And right now is our daily life. Okay, so we are aware of that, no matter whether we're, you know, in formal meditation or break time or whatever, trying to create certain causes and abandon other ones. And if we do that, then at the time when death comes around, we'll be able to take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha. Our mind will be peaceful because we have that trust and confidence in the Buddha Dharma Sangha. We won't have any regret because we followed the law of cause and effect. And so then we can die without regret. We can die without fear, you know, because we have that confidence that comes from having created a lot of virtue in our life and having purified the non-virtue and not, you know, stopped creating it. And so then we die peacefully, and then because our mind is in that happy state, some good karma ripens, and we have a good rebirth. Okay? So that's the first, most immediate thing. If we want to get to Buddhahood, what we have to do. Okay? Then, the second step is that to understand that if we get a good rebirth, that's great, but it's not the end of the path. So it's kind of like you get to Seattle, but you're not there yet, you know? You're not in Dharamsala yet. It's not the end of the path. And if you just stay in Seattle, well, then you have to deal with Seattle traffic. You have to deal with, you know, the crowds and everything else. So you don't want to just hang out in Seattle your whole life, okay? You really want to get to Dharamsala. Okay, so you got to develop that motivation to go, don't you? Because before you're going to move, you have to have the motivation. So that's why if we're doing the path in common with a middle-level practitioner, our motivation is the determination to be free from cyclic existence and to attain liberation. Okay? So we want to attain nirvana. We want to get out off this merry-go-round of cyclic existence. That, you know, because cyclic existence means taking the five aggregates, taking the body and mind that's under the control of ignorance, mental afflictions, and our previous actions. You know, samsara is not the world. Samsara is a body and mind under the control of ignorance, mental afflictions, and karma. Okay? So this is samsara. Okay? This body is samsara. Our present confused mind, yeah, no, these aggregates are samsara. Okay. So we need to develop the determination to be free from cyclic existence and attain liberation. So how are we going to develop that motivation, that aspiration? What do we meditate on so that, you know, we see how that's important to do? Well, what we meditate on is the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so the truth of dukkha or unsatisfactoriness. So in that one, we see the disadvantages of cyclic existence. That's the first noble truth. Then second noble truth is the origins, you know, of the dukkha. You know, how did we get involved in cyclic existence? So that says here the nature of the afflictions. Okay. And the factors that stimulate their arising. Yeah. So how is it that cyclic existence comes about? The first two noble truths? Well, first of all, you know, what are the first two noble truths? Well, dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness, suffering. Okay, so we think about the six sufferings, the eight sufferings, the three sufferings. Yeah, if you like lists, Buddhism is the religion for you. Okay? Lots of lists, but they're very helpful for training your mind. Then, you know, so you see all the problems, then what are the causes of the problems? Okay, because we have to discern what the causes of the origin are to see if it's possible to eliminate them. And so that's why we meditate on the mental afflictions. And we, you know, what are these mental afflictions? What are the 10 root afflictions? What are the factors that make them arise in our mind? Okay. So we really get to know them well. It's kind of like if you have a disease, you know, you have to know the symptoms of the disease, but then you have to know the causes of the disease. Because you have to treat the causes of the disease, not just put band-aids on. Okay, so those are the first two noble truths. So when you meditate on that, then that gives you a lot of strong energy, because you say, you know, I've been in cyclic existence since beginningless time. You know, this isn't just, you know, a few years I've been wandering around like this. It isn't just a few lifetimes, but it's beginningless time. You know, and if I don't do anything, then I'm just going to keep doing the same old thing over and over and over and over and over, being totally miserable the whole time. Okay? So we see, you know, either I can break this cycle, or I just keep on repeating the same dumb things again and again and get the same dumb results again and again. Okay? So that's kind of like, you know, when they do these experiments with the mice, and you get the mice to, you know, peck so that it gets a grain of rice. And all you have to do is, like, give it one grain of rice at the beginning, and then it just keeps pecking, 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 pecking. Because it keeps on thinking, next time I'm going to get another grain of rice. And it doesn't. You know, this is the gambling mind. Yeah, the same way that we get hooked into gambling. Yeah, your flight stops in Vegas, and you're changing flights, and everybody's at the one-armed bandits, you know, because they're sure that they're going to win this time. So you keep putting your quarters in, you know, $25, $50 worth of quarters, you know, until your flight leaves. Sometimes, I did a retreat once with some students from Chapman University. They were flying up from Southern California to Portland, because the retreat is at Cloud Mountain. Their flight stopped in Vegas or Reno. They missed their connecting flight. So you get so used to just doing this thing, thinking, I'll find some happiness in samsara somewhere, as you keep putting your quarters in, you know. There's no happiness. Okay, so when you really meditate very, very deeply that there's no lasting happiness or satisfaction in cyclic existence, then you have a very strong urge of basta, finito, I've got to get out of this. You know, it's like enough is enough. Yeah. I don't know about you, but did your mother ever say to you, enough is enough? You know, or maybe it was your father, you know, it's like, and you knew then that you really had to cool it. Yeah. Okay, so this is the same thing that you do with your own mind. It's like, I've been in this mess too long. Enough is enough. I'm getting out myself out of samsara. Finished. Okay, so that's a very strong, clear motivation. And that motivation, wanting to be free of samsara, is actually compassion for ourselves. Okay? Yeah, in ordinary life, we think having compassion for ourselves means, well, I'll sleep an extra 2 hours, I'll have another piece of chocolate cake, I'll go on a holiday. That's not compassion for ourselves. Real compassion for ourselves is wanting ourselves to get out of cyclic existence. Don't you think? You know? Because compassion is wanting someone to be free of suffering. Well, cyclic existence is the ultimate suffering. Wanting ourselves to get out of it is having compassion for ourselves. Okay? So compassion for ourselves and renunciation of suffering are the same thing. Okay? Compassion for ourselves and renunciation of cyclic existence are the same thing. Yeah? So once we have that aspiration, okay, so you see what we meditated on, and we're back in the first column to how we now have that aspiration. Then we go to the third column. What do we practice in order to get ourselves out of cyclic existence? Okay, the three higher trainings. So the higher training of ethical conduct, the higher training of concentration, the higher training of wisdom. Okay. Now, where does monastic life come in? That's the higher training of ethical conduct. Okay? We kind of started it on the path in common with the initial level being, when we were practicing the 10 virtues and practicing abandoning the 10 virtues, because on that level, you know, we're starting to follow cause and effect. But when we're really getting serious about getting out of cyclic existence, you know, our motivation is to get out, but not only to get out, because we want final full enlightenment. Okay, so it's not just to attain liberation, it's also to attain full enlightenment. That's where monastic vows comes in. Okay? As a higher training in ethical conduct. Ethical conduct really helps us subdue our body and speech, which are much easier to subdue than our mind. Okay? The mind is the source of all of our actions. Before our body and speech do anything, the mind has to have a motivation, has to have an intention. Okay? So the mind develops lots and lots of intentions. Some of those get acted out, some of them don't. Okay? So the gross ones get acted out in our verbal activities and in our physical activities. So those two things are much, much easier to control than to control our mind. You know, because we can see all day our mind is like gazillions of thoughts. You know, I like this, I don't like that, give me this, don't give me that, I want this, I want, don't want that, all the day. You know, our mind is just bull. Okay? So to start to tame the mind, we start that by taming the body and speech, because the body and speech are easier to control because those actions are much grosser. Yeah? They're grosser because in order to do them, first your mind has to move. Okay, so there's more ability to stop the negative actions of body and speech. They're much easier to stop than all the afflicted, you know, thoughts in our mind. Okay? Yeah. You know, like you might have a thought of, you know, oh, I really want that no matter what. But then instead of acting it out, you think, if I do that, it's going to get me in trouble. You know, better not. Okay? So you can see the mind isn't yet subdued, but you're able to keep from physically doing the action. So that's good. You know? And the more we start taming our body and mind, I mean our body and speech, because they're grosser, as we're subduing our physical and verbal actions, it's automatically getting us to look at what's going on in our mind. You know? Because, okay, you know, here I am and, you know, I want to snatch something that doesn't belong to me. And then we stop and like, well, where did that thought come from to take that? Yeah? Or the thought comes, you know, I want to tell somebody off. And you're sitting there, you know, ready to tell somebody off. And then you go, uh-oh, maybe I better not do this. Okay? But where did that thought come from that has so much energy that wants to tell someone off? Okay? So you see that by keeping the monastic precepts, or even the five lay precepts, it helps you start to look at your mind and know what your intentions are. Okay? And also, as we study the Vinaya, Vinaya is the monastic discipline, you'll see in the way the Vinaya is set up that there's different levels of transgression. And one of the key elements of transgressing various precepts is what your motivation is. Okay? So, for example, you know, there's a precept, one of our monastic precepts is, you know, one of the root precepts is not to kill a human being. Yeah? So there's a difference between killing a human being intentionally and being in a car accident where you certainly didn't intend to kill anybody. Okay? So when there's the intention to kill, then you break your root vow and your whole ordination is kaput. Okay, but if something happens accidentally like that, it's not a root break because there was no intention for it. Okay, so intention does play a big part, even in the Vinaya, which govern our actions of body and speech. Mm-hmm. from that, from subduing our actions of body and speech, that helps us improve on two mental factors, mindfulness, and then another one that's called alertness, or sometimes it's translated as vigilance or clear comprehension. Okay, so these two mental factors get very strong because you become more aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it, and you become more aware of how you really want to act in the world. So then when you sit down to meditate, it becomes easier to meditate because you have more mindfulness, you have more mental alertness, and also because you've been subduing your body and speech, your mental, your physical and verbal actions, then you have less regret. Because a lot of times when we sit down to meditate, what is it that distracts us in our meditation? So much regret about, you know, bad things we did in the past. Well, as we stop doing those bad things, then we have less regret, less guilt. Then when those things don't fill our minds so much, then it automatically becomes easier to develop concentration. Okay? As we learn to concentrate the mind, then the very gross mental afflictions, the very gross anger, the very gross clinging attachment, those things get temporarily suppressed. They aren't eradicated, they aren't uprooted from the mind, but you aren't bothered by them so much, because when you're in single-pointed concentration, you can't be having all these nutty thoughts, okay? But then, so the concentration itself is a good step to subduing the mind, but it's not the ultimate step, because we haven't uprooted the afflictions. To uproot the afflictions, we need to develop wisdom. Okay? And this is the wisdom that sees things the opposite way from the way that ignorance sees things. Okay? Because ignorance sees things in a completely distorted way. Because we see things in a distorted way, we make things very solid, we project that they have their own essence, and their everything becomes solid and truly existent and some objective independent reality out there. Because we put all of that, you know, that's how we see things, then attachment, resentment, belligerence, you know, all these other kinds of mental afflictions arise, and then those are the mental afflictions that make us act in harmful ways, or, you know, even we act in constructive ways, still there's some ignorance in the mind, so we keep revolving in cyclic existence. Okay? So we need to cut the root of the ignorance, which means that the way ignorance, what ignorance is perceiving, we have to realize doesn't exist. Okay? So it's like, you know, if you're going to be relaxed in the garden where you're seeing a person, you have to realize it's not a person, it's a scarecrow. Yeah, you getting what I mean? So you have to realize if ignorance is grasping onto the scarecrow as being a person, and then you get afraid and you get all hung up, you can't just say, I won't look at the person. Yeah? Because your mind is still, you know, there's a person in the garden, you know, doesn't want me to be there. But you have to actively realize that there is no person there. And that it's a scarecrow. So similar thing, the way ignorance perceives things as objective reality, with wisdom we have to see no. What ignorance thinks exists is totally non-existent. That's not how it is. Things are not independent entities. You know, they are dependent. Yeah, things are dependent. They depend on cause and condition. They depend on parts. They depend on our mind, which conceives and labels them. Okay? So we develop this wisdom that learns to see things as they are. Okay, which is the opposite way from how ignorance sees them. So that's how we attain liberation. But remember, we aren't aiming just for liberation from samsara. Okay? We don't want to just Okay, we got to Seattle. Yeah. Now we've gotten to Tokyo. Tokyo is like you know, liberation. But that's not, we don't want to just hang out in Tokyo either. We're not in Dharamsala yet. Okay, so we have to keep going. Yeah, because otherwise if you just get to Tokyo and then, oh yeah, there's nice sushi places, and, you know, hang out in Tokyo. But, you know, no, I want to get to Dharamsala. Okay, so getting ourselves to Dharamsala, that's like the path of the advanced level practitioner. Okay? So, what do we have to, what aspiration is it that we're going to generate to get us, you know, we want to get to full enlightenment? The aspiration that's going to get us there is the bodhicitta, or the altruistic intention. And the definition of bodhicitta, and this is really good to remember, okay, it's a primary mind with two aspirations. One aspiration to work for the benefit of sentient beings, and the second aspiration to become a fully enlightened Buddha, to be able to do so. Okay? So bodhicitta doesn't just mean being a nice person. Okay? It means that you're set on full enlightenment for the purpose of being of the greatest benefit to everybody. Okay, and everybody doesn't mean just human beings. It's all animals, insects, all kinds of life forms, everybody. Okay, so that's the altruistic intention of bodhicitta. Okay, what do we need to meditate on in order to make that aspiration arise in our mind? Because it's not going to come out of nowhere. You know, these good aspirations need to be cultivated. Okay, so there's two main methods for generating bodhicitta. Before we do either of them, we have to practice equanimity. And what equanimity means is getting rid of the attachment to friends, the aversion to enemies, and the apathy towards everybody else. Okay? So we have to work at equanimity first. Then, on the basis of that, then there's two ways to actually generate this altruistic intention. One is the seven-point instruction of cause and effect. The second is equalizing, exchanging self and others. Okay? Those are two different methods. Sometimes there's also a way of combining them so that you practice them intertwined. And there's no contradiction in doing that. Okay? If you're doing the seven-point instruction of cause and effect, first, you recognize that all sentient beings have been your mother. Okay? And we use mother because most of us see our mother as somebody kind. It could be your father. It could be whoever took care of you when you were young. You know, a relative or a babysitter, whoever it was. Okay? So we recognize all sentient beings as our parents. Then we think of the kindness of our parents. Okay? And then we think that all these sentient beings have been our parents and been kind to us like our present parents. And then automatically we want to repay that kindness. Okay? And then we develop love for them because we see them, we want them to be happy. We develop compassion because we want them to be free of suffering. We develop the great resolve, which is the intention to bring about their happiness and reduce their suffering. And then we develop the bodhicitta in order to be able to do so. So the first six, one through six there on your chart, are the causes, and then bodhicitta is the effect. So that's why it's called the 7 points of cause, 7 point instruction of cause and effect. Then equalizing, exchanging self and others, that's the other method for developing bodhicitta. So then you equalize self and others, realizing that other sentient beings and myself, we both equally want to be happy and don't want to suffer. There's no reason to think that my happiness is any more important than anybody else's. Then we see the disadvantages of being self-centered. We see the benefits of cherishing others. And then we exchange self and others, which means, what that means is that as important as I held myself before, that's how important I hold others now. And as unimportant as I used to hold others, that's how unimportant I hold myself now. Okay, so we exchange who's the most important. On the basis of that, then we do the taking and giving meditation, where we imagine taking on others' suffering and then giving them our happiness. And then from there, we develop the altruistic intention of bodhicitta. Okay? So once we've used either or one of those or both of those methods, yeah, then we cultivate the aspiration for full enlightenment for the benefit of other beings. That's the bodhicitta aspiration. Then what do we practice in order to attain that? Okay? So on the what's called the perfection vehicle or paramitayana, okay, we practice we do the six far-reaching practices. So we have generosity, ethical conduct, patience, joyous effort, meditative stabilization, and wisdom. Okay. After we practice those, then we practice the four ways of gathering disciples. You know, because we want to lead sentient beings to enlightenment, we have to know how to gather disciples. So we do that by being generous, by speaking pleasant, by encouraging them to practice, and by acting according to what we teach. Okay? Then, after we've practiced all that, then we do the path of Tantra. Then we take, have Tantric initiation and do the Tantric practice. Okay? Now, since we are ultimately aiming for the highest enlightenment, okay, when we're doing the path in common with the middle level practitioner, when it says what do we practice, you know, in order to attain that ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom, we're practicing those, but at the same time we're developing bodhicitta. Okay? Because we don't want to just practice the wisdom with the intention of gaining only nirvana. Because then we'll enter into the path of what's called the hearers or solitary realizers. Those are different people who want to just attain their own individual liberation. Okay? So we're not wanting to do that. We're wanting to attain full enlightenment for everybody's benefit. So we're not completely going into concentration and wisdom full force when we're practicing the path in common with the middle level practitioner. We're training the mind in that, but we're not doing it full force because we see that we really want to cultivate the bodhicitta. Okay? So when we've cultivated the bodhicitta, then you'll see that those same two things come within the context of the six far-reaching attitudes. Meditative stabilization is essentially concentration, and then the far-reaching attitude of wisdom, and then the higher training of wisdom come to the same point. Okay? So, this is a lot of material. If you can't remember it all, if you feel like your head's full, that's okay. Yeah, that's okay. Because, you know, as much as you can remember of this, then it will benefit you. And what I would really suggest is, you know, really spend some time with this chart over the next few days and try and look at each one of those things and remember what you heard about it. Okay? And discuss it amongst yourself. And, you know, remember as much as you can. And then this is also one of the reasons why it's very helpful to have books, you know, or to transcribe teachings. Because when you transcribe the teachings, it makes you pay attention so you remember better. And then when you have a book in front of you that has it all explained, then you can go, oh, I forgot why we practiced this point. This is so confusing. You know, so much information in 45 minutes, I can't absorb it all. But then you have a book, you can go back and you can read it, you can get familiar with it. Okay? Because it's very important to understand that when we're learning the Dharma, It's not like learning other topics. You know, in regular school, we're expected to understand everything the first time we hear it. In Dharma, we're not expected to understand everything the first time we hear it. Yeah? We fully know that, you know, sometimes we're just hearing it and it's planting seeds in our mind. You know, maybe all you remember from this talk is that there's three levels of spiritual practitioners. If that's all you remember, that's great, because it's more than you knew before. Okay? And the next time you hear that teaching, you won't be so, feel so unfamiliar. Oh yeah, three levels of spiritual practitioners, I remember that. And so then that time you'll be able to concentrate a little bit better on some more of the details. Okay? And you still won't remember or understand everything. But the second time, you'll understand a little bit more. It's, you know, starts to become a little bit more familiar. You remember those words. Oh yeah, that word bodhicitta, I remember that. I can't remember what it means, but I remember I heard that word before. Okay? So the second time then, like, oh yeah, that's not so unfamiliar. So then, you know, you listen to it, you understand it a little bit better the second time. Okay? So, you know, really in learning the Dharma, don't expect yourself to master everything the first or the second or the third time. It's very much a thing of hearing it again and again, thinking about it again and again, contemplating it, meditating on it again and again. You know, and in terms of accomplishing the path, you know, this is going to take us some time. So don't kind of think, oh, you know, I heard the teaching, I should be able to sit down and all of this is going to magically appear in my mind, you know, and I'm going to be instantaneously this great compassionate being. Okay, I'm going to be Chenrezig by tomorrow morning. Okay, no, it's going to take us some time. So we practice step by step by step, constantly familiarizing ourselves again and again and again with these things. Okay? So it's very, very important to have that kind of framework. Yeah? And give yourself some space so that you can learn things gradually and become familiar with things gradually. Okay? That's really, really important. Yeah?